Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for joining us. Welcome to the Jenny Strozier Keeping It Real show. And we have a very special treat for you today, and I will let Jenny Strozier tell you about it. Jenny Strozier is a man who once was locked away. He was, in fact, incarcerated for 46 years in the Georgia prison system. However, he was freed on July 31st, 2013, and will soon celebrate his first year ever as a free man. Because when he was locked away, he was only 10 years old, and he lived behind bars from age 10, that was in 1968, all the way up to 2013. He gives delightful talks here on Blog Talk Radio, Human Rights Demand, every Friday evening at 6:30 p.m. His talks are designed to discourage youth from incarceration, to discourage released prisoners from recidivism. So much insight. Please don't miss it. Ask your friends and neighbors not to miss it. Go ahead and call them now and let them know that Jenny Strozier, Keeping It Real, is on the air and live right now. After the broadcast, you will be able to access this show on tape. After the broadcast, you will be able to access this wonderful show on tape. But here Jenny Strozier is with a special surprise for the radio audience today. Hello, Jenny Strozier. How are you?
How you doing, Miss Neer? I'm doing just fine. And just having a wonderful time right here in the Lord. You know, just trying to clear my head about some things so I can just move forward in life.
Wonderful. And you brought someone with you today, is that right?
Yes, I have a special guest, you know, that lady that I met back in 2000, that I was writing from prison, the same lady that I married in 2005, which is my wife, who once that went through with me through the struggle, that knew that she experienced firsthand what I was going through. Because once she started coming to visit me, writing me, sending me money, sending me packages, standing by me as a woman and as a friend, we fell in love when we got married in April the 5th of 2005. And I'm going to bring her on and let her tell her story about what she experienced in the Georgia prison system, because when I was doing the time, she was doing the time also. Well, she didn't have to do the time, but she did it with me anyway, because it was her calling from God. So hopefully when she called in, we can get started. But anyway, I'm just going to go ahead on.
Hello?
Yes, this is Maddie?
I am here.
Maddie?
This is Maddie.
I want y'all to know that this is Maddie Scholes. This is my wife. And I'm going to let her tell her own story in her own words, because not only did I have a testimony, she also have a testimony that she went through the struggle of the Georgia prison system and the walls, the dead ends that she went through, and how she came out, and how God blessed her, you know what I mean, and how she been dealing with this thing, you know what I mean, that when we came out, we was living together, but he was seen to judge the wrong way, and I was made to move. So right now, as it stands, we living in two different cities. She living in Union City, and I'm living in South College Park, and we only can visit each other when we can. That is marriage couple. So I'm going to let Ms. Maddie Scholes, my wife, come on and let her tell you her side and how she feels. And what's on her mind. Okay, audience? So, Ms. Maddie Strozier,
Good evening, radio audience, and Ms. Mary. I am indeed pleased to be able to have this opportunity, and I thank you so much. As my husband was saying, we met around 2000, and what happened, to go back, I was single, and I said to God, I know you don't want me out here just running around anywhere, and I know you have the husband for me. And I remember saying, God, I know you have the husband for me. If you have to go into the prison and clean him up for you, then that would be the man for me. 2 weeks later, I got a call from my sister, and she said, there's a letter at my house, and it's addressed to you. And first I thought, who could it be? I said, is it a prison guard or whatever? Because several years back, I was involved in the men in prison ministry at my church, the Kingdom Come Church. And she said, no, I don't think so. Well, I laid it aside for about a week or two because I was just like, I don't believe this. And one of my friends said, you remember when you prayed to God? He heard your prayer. And I think it was he answered so quick, it frightened me. So I started to write and correspond with Johnny. And once I started to write him and hear his story, I was very interested and intrigued because I felt like I had had struggles in my childhood, but there was nothing compared to what this man had been through. So like the Bible said, we'll be drawn by the blood of the Lamb and the word of his testimony. Well, his testimony drew me. It got my attention because, Miss Mary and audience, I didn't understand how a man who had been incarcerated for so long still had the faith in God that one day he was going to walk out that door. He was being told by some of the wardens and all that he would never leave unless he left in a pine box. How did he continue to keep to have the faith in God and with all he went through on a daily basis? So I began to write him, and I remember the first time I went to visit him, and that was at Reedfield State Prison. Growing up, we called that the chain gang here in Georgia, and that was one of the worst prisons in the state that we knew about. And as I began to sit down and talk to him and realize that this was a very intelligent man, that he was a man who first loved the Lord, and I said that had to be a requirement. And a man who my husband sings, he writes poetry, and I encourage him to keep it and put it in a book and have it copyrighted. He survived so much in there, and I would go to see him and visit him. And then when we were getting ready to get married, some ministers would not marry people who are incarcerated, or sometimes the system doesn't want you to do so as well. But I asked my pastor. He said he would, but before that, I asked the judge in jail care, and she said, yes, she would. So on April the 5th, 2005, on my spring break, my pastor, his late wife, and my sister were my witnesses at Telfair State Prison. We got married about 1, and, you know, we had to, you know, part then, and I had to come back home, and you know, they sent him, you know, to several prisons. I've been through to about 10 prisons in the last 10 years. And I can tell you out there, for the young people, too, who may be listening, when you go there, you're only allowed to hold hands or to kiss them coming in and going out. You are not allowed to have physical contact while you're in the visitation room. You are watched closely, and if they think that you are too close or you are too intimate, then they will ask you to move away or to separate. And if you continue to violate their rules, your visitation can be denied. I traveled as far north to see my husband as the Tennessee state line and far south as the Florida state line. I have shared this story with few people, not that I was ashamed of my husband or anything he's done. My family and my network became other family members who had incarcerated family members because they understood what I was going through and I understood what they were going through. And my husband and I are still in contact with a lot of those people today because they're still our extended family. I can remember going to places and staying in hotels and, you know, in the small towns here in Georgia by myself. A lot of times I travel by myself because, as a lot of people will tell you, sometimes there's only one or two persons that will come to visit you in prison. I met so many people and learned about so many different ways, even the pardon parole board. I ended up talking to some of the examiners and going to parole board meetings on Tuesdays and talking to some of them, and even finding out, and even at that, some of the people are prejudiced to the crimes that the inmates have committed. And I had to say to one of them, I don't feel that you will give him a fair chance or anyone else, because this happened to someone else that you know. I remember going four times, and I can remember my husband being moved four times that year. But audience and Miss Mary, I had made up in my mind, no matter where you send my husband, I will be there, because I want you all to know he's not proud of his past. I'm not agreeing to what he did, but here is a new man, a changed man. Give him a chance. I can remember a lot of times we went to the Milledgeville family meeting, that I encourage anybody who has an incarcerated loved one to go online to the Department of Corrections and Pardon and Parole and find out when the family's meetings are. And that way you can go and talk to the warden and the staff face-to-face and let them know that here I am or here we are. We care about this inmate. We're going to be watching how you treat this inmate. We're going to be watching how you take care of this inmate. There were times when I had to call them about my husband. My husband has glaucoma, and the medications were not given at times, or the glasses prescription was not there. And I would call downtown to the State Department, Department of Corrections, and let them know how he was being treated. Sometimes I was kind of fearful because I feared retaliation, but my husband always assured me, do what you have to do. You know, there are grievances that, you know, he had to write. A lot of times he was being, you know, mistreated, and he knew the SOP rules, the standard operating procedures. He was very versed in those rules and regulations, so they knew, too, that he was aware of what was going on, and he kept abreast and current of all the things that were going on in the prison system and tried to help the younger and older inmates, anybody he could help, to learn the system, to obey the guidelines. But when you were abused, then there was also something you could do. So he became a mentor in there to younger and older inmates in a positive way. They looked up to him. So, you know, I knew that he was very active in the church there and singing, and my husband loves to cook and bake, and he received his baking certificate, really, you could say twice, because once he received it the first time, they discontinued the OJ on-the-job training program, and he had to take it again, only getting one certificate. But all this time, going back up and forth down the road, I don't regret one day of it. Sometimes I was physically tired and not feeling well, but I knew if I didn't get there to see him, that that would be disappointing. Writing him, sending packages, doing those kind of things. A lot of times people ask me, well, why are you doing this? You don't know what kind of person this is. But I believe in giving a person a chance, and I believe if anybody deserves a chance at a good life, my husband deserved one, because he has been through so much. He has paid for what he had done. Even like he told you, when he came home, he was washing my car, and somebody spotted his monitor and called and went to the management, and they evicted him immediately. My husband has had to live since November, and separated. He's had two different locations that he's moved to, and the sad part about it is sometimes it's just like they're still incarcerated, because if you're not going to give people a chance and give them a job, if you're not going to give them housing or help, then the recidivist rate in Georgia is high because of that. Right now, my husband loves children, and he counsels them and tells them about how not to get in trouble and not to go to prison. and wanting to start a ministry to help keep the kids out of prison. So he has a lot that he wants to do. And, you know, even when he came out, there were stricter guidelines than we thought. And I just cried for a whole week having to make the decision to sign some of the paperwork to put him on the restrictions that they were going to put him on, although he had served his time. So I just, on a daily basis, we continue to communicate. We continue to, you know, he continues to search for that job that will sustain him because he is a man who wants to take care of his family and who has dreams and ideas. And a lot of times I just pray that he gets an attorney that will look into his case and see the mistreatment and overturn some of those things that were done to him just because he had a past record. And I say this to the young people all the time. Black and white follows you everywhere you go. And the sad part sometimes, a lie will follow closer than the truth. So I just want to say thank you to Miss Mary and the audience for listening. Johnny, are you still listening?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Is there anything you want me to cover? Or have
I? I want you to cover, you know, that out of all the things that you remember when in prison, you know, how you came to visit me and how you learned about the system and how I was telling you about the SOP, you know, the SOP, the LOP, and the OCGA. Well, it's a difference with the SOP. It's the old rules and regulations, but then they changed it to the SOP, which is stand for Standards Operation Procedures. But also you had a OCGA, and that's consistent of a Georgia law, a law that they put me up under, and they told me it was a law. But I couldn't find it nowhere in a law book, and I still haven't seen it to the day when they brought me out of prison July the 31st and put me up under this law that I can't never see. If I can't see a law, I know it's a law. You just told it to me, but you ain't showed it to me. Since I've been out of prison, I've been having to, I had to go get a room. I pay $115 a week. And then I just got a part-time job. And then I have to pay. Then they took the electronic monitor off of me and put it on my phone and told me I got to pay them $115. So now I got to pay $230 for that situation. Then they told me I had to change phones. Well, that's another $40 that I got to pay to keep my phone on so they can track me up on the GPS. Everywhere I go, they got to track me. They know where I'm at in the state of Georgia. No, I haven't left the state of Georgia. Well, you got people that come out of prison, they got murder cases, they got rape cases, they got child molestation cases, they got every other kind of case it is that don't wear electronic monitor. But because of my time that I served in the Georgia prison system for over 46 years, for over 46 years of my life as a young man, going into prison, being abused, mistreated, rejection, put down, beat up. People in prison beat me with axe handles and handcuffed me. They put handcuffs on me. They hung me in my cell. They tried to kill me. They didn't know what to do with me. They tried to beat me up. That didn't work. They hospitalized me. That didn't work. They put other inmates on me and tried to stab me. That didn't work. Then they turned around and the officers came in my cell and put some shackles on me and hung me in my cell, and that didn't work. So they couldn't find no other way to kill me. So they gave me the name The Cat. My name became to be The Cat in prison. You remember they said The Cat had 9 lives. So I guess I had 9 lives. But you know, while I was in prison, going through what I went through, I thought about what Josie went through. I thought about the situation Josie was in when his brother sold him into slavery. I thought about the situation Joseph was in when he was rejected and mistreated and thrown into prison for something he didn't even do. I thought about that situation. You know, while being in prison, being around people that was in there for murder, all different kind of murder, murder one, two, three, and four. I was in there with people that was in there for contract killing. I was in there with rapists. I was in there with armed robbers. But here I was, a man in the Georgia prison system that didn't ever have any one of them cases. I didn't have a case. I didn't come in society. I didn't rob nobody. I ain't never killed nobody. I ain't never raped nobody. I ain't never sodomized nobody's children. But being in prison around these people when I came out of prison, then they started treating me like I was one of those people. So being in society, going through my struggle and my battle daily, being separated from my wife daily, being having to go to sleep at night by myself, have to wake up in the morning by myself, I feel like I'm still in prison. Sometimes I call the people in society the warden, because when I get up, I got to go through a whole nother set of rules and regulations. I got the parole officers pulling up in my yard, pulling up on my job, and talking about he needs to talk to me, and telling me all these things about what I got to do. I got to do this. I got to do that. I thought I was on the road. I thought I was being free. I thought I was coming out here to live a life, make a life for myself. You know, every time they knock me down, I get right back up. Like I told y'all weeks and weeks and weeks, I was like an Afro cone. They bend me down. You know, you take an Afro cone, you can bend it all the way down. But when you let it go, you know that Afro cone do, it'll pop right back in place. And God, that's what I was. Yeah. Huh?
I said, God is good. He keeps allowing you to go, and you come out stronger. And just like you were saying, you know, even having to go to, like, a psychiatrist, when you know that, yeah, we all might need to talk to somebody, but for the reason they're sending you. Plus, it's expenses coming out of your pocket. When you don't have the job, they don't care, because the criteria that you expect to meet, if it costs, they still expect you to be able to pay that. And then it's repercussions if you don't, because they want to say you're violating your parole. And it's sad that the assistance is not here when these men and women come out to help them at least for 6 months with a job, housing, a car, or a motor car, because society might say that they're paying taxpayers' dollars, but those like myself and other families, we put money in those vending machines. That's our money. We put gas in our cars to go down there. That's our money. We spend money in hotels to go down there. A lot of people think that the inmates are sitting in prison having a good time just because they can watch TV. Or sitting there having to watch TV when you could get stabbed to death, cut up, beat to death. So it's not glorified like the public may take it until you get on the inside and people see. Yes, some people, what bothers me, want to say, well, yeah, they committed the crime, but God forgave and allowed us chances as those of us who believe in him and believe in redemption. And like I said to the Pardon and Parole Board at one time, Department of Corrections, when is rehabilitation going to start and punishment is going to end? Because it has to be a balance there. There has to be now, educate people, prepare them to come out. Some of them are not prepared because the classes that they had in the prisons are being cut out. People think that they should be there and be mistreated. Then when people return and you've mistreated them, what is that going to be like for them? So there's a lot that people don't know, the expenses that, like he said, he's still expected to pay. You know, I'm on a fixed income. He's trying to start over. I'm trying to get retrained to go to have a job, because I know what he wants to do as a man of his family, and it could be stressful wanting to do. And going, my husband, I live in a small town, he's gone from place to place, door to door, restaurant to restaurant, looking for a job and asking for work. He's always out there trying to cut grass, trying to paint, trying to do those things. and it's been hot, and there's sometimes I'm concerned about him. People are not like they used to be. They're not kind-hearted like they used to be. And sometimes when people find out that people have been incarcerated, they feel like they can take advantage of them. They feel like, you know, these are not people like other people, and they're stereotyped a lot. So, you know, I know that it's a lot of work to be done, but I think a lot of times it needs to start with family and society, because if we don't help each other, you never know when your son or your daughter may be incarcerated. And in Georgia, it's not hard to get incarcerated. If you don't have a good lawyer, like my husband has not had the best legal representation, another reason people are in there. Everybody in there is not guilty. They just can't prove their innocence. You know, we don't have the money a lot of times to hire the Johnny Cochran or the Bruce Harveys. And they're not doing pro bono work like they used to. You know, I would plead for that sometimes, because some of these cases are sad. My husband has spent all this time and now trying to start his life over out here. And like he's saying, we know that there was going to be a probationary period, but 18 years of being on probation, I mean, come on. He spent 46 years. So, you know, my prayer is that somebody, and I pray for mercy, that somebody sees the injustice and start to do some things about it, because it's too common. It's really too common. It keeps repeating itself.
You know, Otis, I was telling y'all about the struggle that me and my wife have, and Miss Mary know also, that, you know, we was trying to, we start off on Johnny Scholes' re-interest form. You know what I mean? Well, if you feel that you can help, or if God leads on your heart to help, you can send money to the fund, and you can send it directly to to Western Union, whatever, how y'all want to do it. I think Miss Mary can input on that, how to do it, because I really don't know too much about how you can set stuff up. And, you know, that's one of the things that prison do to you when you're staying there so long. You really don't know nothing. You really don't know how to use a cell phone, or you got to come back out here and learn how to do this, and you got to learn how to do that. But one thing you don't forget, you don't never learn how to work. Because, see, in the Georgia prison system, they'll work you to death, and they won't pay you nothing.
Free.
You know, you'll be like a 12, you remember the movie 12 Years a Slave? Well, that's where you'll be. You'll be just like that man on 12 Years a Slave. You'll work, and you won't get no respect. So, you know, like, return to society, they only give you $15 out of 46 years of my life in prison. I walked out July the 31st with only $15 in my pocket that the state of Georgia gave me for all the work I did in 46 years. But to say that, to say this, him, I walked out of prison with nothing but me and God and my wife. I came out of prison, and I said to myself, it got to be a better way. If working and staying out of prison, if going to work don't keep me out of prison, sure, I'll work 4, 5, 6 jobs. You know what I mean? If I can get 4, 5, 6 jobs, I go work 4, 5, 6 jobs if it's going to keep me out of prison, because it's better being out here in society than it is than being in prison. I've been out almost 1 year, July the 31st. You know, no one has stepped up to the plate and say, Mr. Spolger, I'd like to help. No one has stepped up to the plate but Miss Mary. I met Miss Mary a while back on the forum. We talked, and this lady has been a wonderful inspiration to me, motivated me, gave me the will to just move on. You know, it was Miss Mary has not only become my friend, but she has become my mentor and also my sister in Christ. You know, a lot of people say that they're your sisters and they're your brothers. But if they haven't been there for you, you remember when Jesus said, you remember they said, Jesus, your mother and your sister and your brothers him. Jesus said, my mother and my sister are already him. You know, so Jesus recognized the people that were in his corner. And just like me, I recognize the people that's in my corner. You know, I would come on the radio and plead. I'm not a man to plead and beg for nothing. You know what I mean? But I'm asking the general public for help. I'm pleading to the general public right now for help. I'm pleading that if you can make a donation to the John Scoldy Reentrance Fund, it's going to help me be a better person. It's going to help me be a better person. I decree and I declare it's going to help me be a better person, because I once was on the bottom, but God has risen me to the top. And if I fall while I'm on the top, I won't stay down. I will still get back up, and I will still move on. I have people call me and ask me to come do an autobiography last Wednesday at Ricky Brown Next Step Staffing. Ricky Brown been a real good friend to me. When I first got out, Ricky Brown gave me my first job, making $10 an hour. I had an interview with WALK through Ricky Brown. I had an invitation to go to the NAACP Award with Mr. Ricky Brown. But due to my just getting out of prison and people wanting to take me to higher ground, the state said no. You know, so I kept on working. Even though I wasn't working with Ricky Brown, I went on to work in Piccadilly. I was the cook in Piccadilly. I worked in Piccadilly for about a month and a half, and I started having conversations with other females that was up in my face and trying to demand me around. But to stay in that situation, I resigned, because I know people can go to other people and they can make accusations, and like you being a convicted felon, they'll listen to them and throw you right in jail. Well, I went on to work in CNN. I was chef at CNN for a little while and left there. You know, try to keep a job, try to keep a good job. I'm a hard worker. I work anywhere doing anything at any time. As long as you're paying me, because I remember back in Reedsville when I was working in the bean field, when I was getting up at 7 o'clock in the morning, working at 7 o'clock at night, picking beans and spring beans and rutabagas and squashes, and sitting out in the hot sun, 125-degree heat, sucking some corn, cutting up some cucumbers, some carrots. I remember sitting in the middle of the field cutting onions. You know, it came to be a thing for me every day to get up and go to work. Even though I did that type of work, and I came back in to my cell, and I went in my cell, a little 4x5 cell, took a shower, went in there and laid down, and it feel like the wall just closed in on me. You know, I remember being up in prison in my cell, you know what I mean, wondering, well, I'm going to die today. Is somebody going to kill me going down the hall?
Yeah.
I remember a lot of times you'd be scared to go to chow. You'd be scared to close your eyes because of people being killed around you, officers killing you. Yeah, the officers killed a lot of people in prison. You know, I like to tell the truth. The officers killed a lot of inmates in prison. And then they'll tell their mamas and their daddies that they found them dead, laying around the corner or laying in a ditch. All the time, they'd be the committed to murder. Yeah, a lot of officers got away with murder in prison, murdering inmates, women husbands, and murdering mother's sons, and murdering mother's daughters, and doing all type of evil stuff that they was getting away with in prison. And I knew about it. And that's one of the reasons I did 46 years in prison, because I knew about it. And they didn't want me to get out and tell about it. They didn't want me to talk about it. But God said, I'm going to let you out. Man said, you're going to never get out. But God said, I'm going to let you out. So I started, God told me back in 2012, he said, if you make a plan, I direct that plan. So every time man slammed the door in my face. God opened the door. God opened, every time you slam one door, God opened two doors. You know? So I remember my chaplain. I remember this black lady coming to me and telling me about getting in the choir. And I remember getting in the choir with this lady, Chaplain Moss. And Chaplain Moss was a good lady, a woman of God, that was a long her past. When I heard about her testimony, it shook me. I know that I wanted to be around this type of woman, like Jesus. Jesus didn't come back for the good. He came back for the bad. And when she was telling me about her situation, I asked her to let me sing in the chaplain's choir. I couldn't sing in anybody else's choir, but I can sing in the chaplain's choir. So I joined the chaplain's choir. And when I was in the chaplain's choir, God anointed me to play the tambourine. I couldn't play the gong, and I couldn't play the piano, and I couldn't play I couldn't sing a song like I wanted to sing it. Well, let me tell you something. I was anointed to play them tambourines. You hear me? And I played them tambourines. Even when they throw me and locked me in the hole, I played them tambourine. And then when I went to church, I played them tambourine. When they called me up there and told me I was going home and had me call my wife and call my family and tell them I was going home, then 5 minutes later, they came back and took my parole. I didn't give up. I went on to church and I played them tambourine. See what I'm saying? And I prayed God. And the whole while I was up in there praising God, they said, man, you know, the inmate looked at me and they said, man, you both went home yesterday. What happened? I said, you know, the devil always throw stuff up and try to stop me. I said, but you know what? I'm going to keep on playing this tambourine. I'm going to keep on coming to church. I'm going to keep on praising God. I'm going to go on back to the dorm. I'm going to book me a ramen noodle soup and eat me some saltine and sit on down and do what I got to do. You know what I'm saying? But then, you know, my wife told me, said, baby, what you going to do? I said, well, baby, you know, I said, they told me I wasn't coming home. I said, but you know, I ain't going to give up. I still got a plan. I said, I still got a plan. I know that God is going to let me out. I'm just going to wait on him. I ain't going to wait on the parole board. I ain't going to wait on the judge. I ain't going to wait on the lawyers. I ain't going to wait on the warden. I said, I'm going to wait on God. July the 31st. I called my wife and I told her, baby, you can come pick me up. God said, I'm going home. You follow what I'm saying? So she said, can I come pick you up this time? I said, you come on down here and get me. You can get me at 8 o'clock. When she got there, there was some red tape going on again. When she got there, I both left out of the prison at 8 o'clock. But they were so shook. They were so shook like it was when God told Joseph he was going to shake the whole prison and the chain was going to fall off and they were going to walk up out of there. See, God shook Make a State. Make a State didn't want to let me go. Make a State, 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, here it is 11 o'clock. I'm just walking out the Make a State prison because God said I would. And wasn't nothing man can do to stop it.
Amen.
Now I'm free out here in society, and I tell all young men that I meet on the train, the Amtrak train, the model train, or wherever we at, I tell all young men, if you make a plan, God will direct that plan. Don't give up, and don't never let nobody tell you what you can't do. People always say, you ain't going to never mount to this. You ain't going to never mount to that. Well, I'm telling you right now, don't worry about what man said. Put your hand in God's hand, and God's going to lead you in the right direction. He ain't going to lead you in the wrong direction because you have to always remember that the battle is in your mind. It ain't in your hand, it ain't in your feet. People always think that when a man put a gun out of his hand, it's in his hand. It's the battle is in your mind. The devil is in your mind. That's the only way that he can attack you is in your mind. That's why George Miles wrote a book called The Battlefield of the Mind. And once I started reading that book, when I got through reading, I gave it to my wife. I said, hey, babe, I'm going to give you this book called The Battlefield of the Mind. She read the book. Now she know that the battle starts in the mind. See, the devil throw all kind of stuff at you, but the battle is in the mind. So I always tell people, if you think right, guess what? You will act right. I've been out here. I did 4 to 6 years in prison. I've been out here a whole year. I haven't been in no kind of trouble. I go where I'm supposed to go, be where I'm supposed to be, and be on time. You know what I'm saying? So that's the way God wanted, and that's the way I want it. You know, I meet a lot of interesting people that I meet out in society. You know, my wife once told me, said, if you ride a train, you'll meet somebody that needs somebody to work on a job. You'll never know what you can do until you take a step out. See, once you take one step, God gonna take two. Every step you take, God gonna double up. So I went out and I talked to this lady up at the center, at an adult center, and she talked to me, you know what I mean, liked me right off the rip. She called one man, and another man called another man. Now I got a job. I got a part-time job. It's just a part-time job, but it's better than having no job. You know, it's better getting up in the morning and going to a job instead of going out down the corner. You know what I mean? I don't want to be on the corner. I don't want, God did not do me 4 to 6 years for me to come out and stand on the corner. He did not do me 4 to 6 years for me to go out there and pick up a gun and rob somebody, or go out there and grab somebody, or do something stupid to go back. That's what they're waiting on me to do. They're waiting on me to go back. But guess what? I got a plan. See, when I got a plan, see, I start making a plan, then God's going to direct that plan. See, I said, if you can't get a job, make a job. So when I didn't have no job, I started cutting grass. I know that I can cut grass. You follow what I'm saying? My pastor once told me about this man that cut grass. He said the man cut grass. He was a young man. See, he couldn't read, but he cut grass. I remember when I couldn't read, but this young man cut this grass. And, you know, this young man always tote a Bible in his pocket, but he couldn't read. And he always had a pencil next to his Bible. And, you know, people used to always make fun of this young man. They were saying, why you toting that Bible? You can't read. You got a pencil. You know you can't write. And I remember one day, you know, the young man said, well, I might not can't read, but I know that my name has been signed in the book of life. He means that he know the reason why he told the Bible, because he know that his name had been signed in the book of life. But he couldn't read, but he know that. So I say this here to all young people in society. You know that no matter what you go through, you got to remember that your name has been signed in the book of life. And I just want to say, you know, that my wife has been through her struggles, and she done had her ups and downs, and just this year, my wife got sick, and they told my wife, I went to the hospital, but I remember driving down the street with her. And I remember her telling me that she wasn't feeling good. So I told her, I said, well, just drive right on over into the hospital. I could drive, but I didn't take the wheel. I drove the car right over to the hospital, and she drove over to the hospital. And when she got out, I told the man to bring a wheelchair. So we got her in the wheelchair. He rolled her in, peeped my hospital, found out that she had what that was you had back.
Blood clots in both lungs.
Yeah, she had blood clots on both lungs.
Got it.
We didn't know what was wrong. I pushed in there, and the man told me to go around and park the car. So I went around there, drove the car around there and parked. And it was amazing that I did 4 to 6 years in prison, but I could still drive a car. Huh? I can still drive a car. Thank God, good. Drive a car. I haven't forgot that. That's just how good God is. So I took the car around there. I parked. We went in there. I stayed in there with her all night long in the hospital. You know, because I know that this woman has stood by me all them years. And stood by me. She was my mom when my mom wasn't there. She was my grandma when my grandmama wasn't there. She was my dad and my sisters. You know what I mean? She was my brother. She was my in-law, my input. You know, she was everything. So I know that this woman stood by me. Surely I can go in that hospital and stand by her. So I went in there, and I sat in the hospital room all night long. I watched her go through her pain and agony and everything she was going through. I watched the nurses come in there and give her shot after shot after shot, every hour on the hour. She had shot so many shots on her, you know what I mean? Her arms started turning a different color. You know, I remember them pushing her out, bringing her in, pushing her out. I'm sitting there, I'm still woke. But I'm sitting there, but I got an electronic monitor that beeping like you wouldn't believe. But I'm still sitting there, you know. And I remember going in the hospital room. I was so tired. I could have got in the bed myself. I could have got in the hospital dead woke. That's how tired I was. But, you know, I went back. Her son came in, and I left, and I went on back home. A friend of mine came and picked me up, and I went back home, and I tried to get some sleep, worried about her being in the hospital, worried about her being cold. Most of the time, she was cold in the hospital. I didn't give her that little thin blanket. And I thought, I said, well, you want me to bring you a blanket? She said, no. And she couldn't hardly talk, you know what I mean? But through all that there, through all that suffering that she went through, God still gave her a second chance.
Yes, he did.
If she hadn't went in when she went in, she wouldn't have been here today.
God is good, and that is true.
God is good.
Yes, he is.
God is an on-time God. It's like the song said, he may not be there when you want him, but he's always on time.
Yes, he is.
I say that God been blessing us. You know, recently I told the audience about my grandson, that he discovered, you know, a young man, 15 years old, had never been in no trouble. You know what I mean? That got with the wrong crowd of boys. They went out and did some stupid stuff. And then he got stuck with the whole ordeal. You know, and I'm going to let my wife tell you that story because I think she can tell it better than me. You know what I mean? Because her sister were going up and down the highway trying to see by her grandson. But, you know, the devil kept on attacking him in all areas. Now, you know, since he's been at home, he had none of those problems. As long as he was up in that jail, he had all kinds of problems. And I'm going to let my wife explain that to you about my grandson, DJ.
Well, he's 15, and he was with two other young men. And that's when I tell young people, a lot of times you're guilty by association. You don't have to do anything, but you be with the person that does that. And that's when you need to choose your friends very wisely. Not acquaintances, not these little buddies you just pick up, male or female. And in Georgia, at a certain age, they can charge you as an adult. And it's sad. Right now, they want to charge him as an adult. He didn't commit the crime. He was with the two that, him and another young man, but the third one did, so he went to YDC. And while he was there, they diagnosed him with tuberculosis and diabetes, they said. And then they said later on that he didn't have it. And because he didn't take the medication, they, you know, locked him down for 3 days and all of that kind of thing. The parents went to get him, and they made paperwork. They couldn't get him when they first went to get him. And then when he went back to court, they, you know, had forgotten him and left him at YDC.
I got a call. I'll come right back to you.
Okay. Are we still on air?
Yes, ma'am. You're still on air. This is Mary Neal. How are you doing?
I'm fine. Thank you. Thank you for the time.
I want you to know that you and your husband are doing a wonderful job. You are speaking not only for yourselves, but for literally hundreds of thousands of former inmates who come out of prisons and jails having done their time. They've served their time, and they are so excited about being free again, but they have financial needs and demands that what happens is individuals, certain companies, even that they've been working for behind bars,
will not give them their job, even if they did extremely well working for companies like Boeing Airlines and Starbucks Coffee and Microsoft and all of those big companies behind bars. Even when they come out and they're free, those same companies will not hire them. And this is a very sad circumstance, and I want people to be aware of it, that a very large companies are avoiding paying, you know, our president is trying to get the minimum wage raised to be $11 an hour. But the truth is that many of our major companies are avoiding even paying minimum wage because they are using prison laborers. And then when these men and women have served their time and have left prison, these same companies that they work for, some of them worked as manufacturers, some of them worked as even on computers, some of them did customer service, and all sorts of different jobs are now being done behind bars. But when they are excused from jail, when their release date comes, they cannot go to those very same companies and get hired. And I think that every company that uses prison laborers should have to, and I'm talking to our politicians, these companies should have to set aside so many positions in their very big firms. These are not little companies. They should have to set aside so many positions to fill with their inmates who have been released. We're not asking them to hire untrained people. Some of these people have worked for these big companies behind bars for 5 and 10 years. Some of them have worked for them for 20 years. We're saying hire your employees that you used this man or this woman up while she was a prisoner, reserve so many jobs for your workforce that has been released. I think it's only fair and right that companies that escape paying minimum wage by taking jobs behind bars should also be forced to hire some of their employees at full salary after they finish their term in prison. That would be fair and right. But, you know, as you said yourself, Mrs. Strozier, these people have not the kind hearts. But I say to these big companies, it's not merely being kind-hearted. You already know this person knows how to do the job. In fact, it's being mean-hearted to hire somebody who has never worked for you, don't know how to do the job. You have to spend probably 6 months training them how to do the assembly of your products and et cetera. Why would you go through all of that rather than hiring one of your employees from prison? I'm asking you, big companies, to please do the right thing and hire your former employees who've been released from prison. Give these men and women full salary and an opportunity. Yes, sir, Mr. Strozier.
I was, I had a call and I was just coming back, and I wanted to make sure that I was back on here with you.
Yes.
Okay.
And welcome back. You and your wife were doing so well and giving us so much good information, Mr. Strozier, not just about your own condition, but about the challenges that our ex-convicts meet when they come out and they really want to be reoriented into society. They don't want to recidivate. They want to go forward with their lives. But look at all the roadblocks that society puts in their way. And I was just thinking of the fact that our re-entering men and women, one of the main hurdles that they have to jump is the employment hurdle, because a lot of companies don't want to hire people who have a criminal background. And the truth is that a great many of the people who you're rejecting never even really did a crime. They took a plea deal because they had to. They felt like they would not get a fair trial. In fact, the prosecutor told them they would not get a fair trial. So a great many of the people that the companies are turning down are absolutely innocent of ever having done any crime. And then we have people who have actually done crimes way long ago, and these people are probably the safest employees you can have because they're most determined to stay out of jail. You get somebody who's never been in trouble with the system, who's to say that that person is going to be more honest? I think person who has a probation officer breathing down his neck, I think the person who realizes and remembers seeing someone get beat to death in the cell next door, I think that people who have actually seen how the system mistreats prisoners would probably be your most trustworthy employee. So I want our companies to think about that and give our re-entering men and women a chance. Thank you, Mr. Sturgill, for this time on your show.
You know, I want to put one input in now. You know that I have some information that I've been trying to send you for over, 2 weeks now, ain't it?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
It's so, you know, it's so hard out here in the state of Georgia that you can't even get a stamp. You know what I mean? That's bad. You know, let me tell you something, that, you know, I since I got my job, you know, I go to work every day. I get up at 3 o'clock in the morning just to get started. I get up at 3 o'clock, I go to work every day. Sometimes I walk to work. Sometimes I walk to the train station. That's over 4, 5, 6 miles, you know, because I'm very serious about what I'm doing. And when I do a job, I want it to be the best job I can possibly do. You know, a man told me once, if you're going to do something, let it be the best you got. So I go up and I have to go through 12 train stations just to get to my job downtown. And they noticed him, so they came to me and gave me a bus pass for a whole month. Cause they know I'm going to be on my job. I'm going to go to work. I don't care if it was out in Stone Mountain, on top of Stone Mountain. I'm going to be there before they even open up, you know. But I said, you know, there's a man here in Atlanta. His name is Ricky Brown, and I'm going to go see him Monday and Wednesday. And I'm going to talk to him, Mr. Ricky Brown, about coming on my show, because Mr. Ricky Brown is also an ex-felon, that got out of prison and started his own staffing company for inmates in the state of Georgia. Mr. Ricky Brown is the only black-owned company staffing agent in Atlanta, Georgia, that got a contract with the Georgia, the one that built the Georgia Dome over. He got that contract, and most of the people on that job now is ex-felons, $15 an hour.
Wonderful.
The thing is, Sister Mary was saying, is to get these companies to hire ex-inmates because you have the discipline it takes to hold a job and appreciate a job and don't take it for granted. And it would be an asset to any company if they would open their doors. And then, too, I have to say, when you open your doors to these ex-inmates, male and female, treat them well. Treat them well. That's another thing. People will hire you, but treat them well.
But also, I want to say this, you know that the people in these companies that hire the ex-felons always remember this, that the federal government is bagging these big companies. The federal government is behind these companies to hire ex-felons. Barack Obama put out a thing not too long back about hiring ex-felons because the federal government going to give these big companies and these small companies, these tax write-offs, every defendant they hire 15 of them, they're going to get that $3,200, $3,700, whatever, they get tax write-off just to get this man a job. They call it a federal bonding program.
Wonderful. Well, that's what we need. We need government and private industry to work together, just like they work together and pass tough on crime laws and created this huge prison population. That was a result of government and private companies working together. Don't think it wasn't. And so now, just as you have created this monster, it's time now for government and corporations to work together to help the ex-offenders reorient themselves into society and be living wholesome lives. And no man and no woman can live a wholesome life when you have taken away their only means of income, which for many ex-offenders, their only means of income is to work. Because these people who are, say, I know this isn't you, Mr. Johnny, but there are lots of ex-offenders who were convicted of drug offenses. I know you went to jail when you were 10, and you were not a drug offender. But many, many of our ex-offenders are drug offenders, and they do not qualify for food stamps. They will not let them live with families if the family members live in subsidized housing. So here you are. You've got no housing. You've got no food stamps. That's taking away someone's only subsistence. And then on top of that, you don't want to hire them because of their record. We had a man in Lithonia a couple of years ago who was breaking into people's houses while they were at work. And guess what he stole? He never, ever took anything but food out of the refrigerator. Some houses said they could see where there was somebody that took a shower. What he was doing is eating and taking a shower. And sometimes he'd leave a note and say, I'm sorry or something. And this was happening right here in Lithonia, Georgia. And when I read about that, I figured that that was somebody who was an ex-offender. They were trying to make a decent life. He would go in, he would break in somebody's house. That's wrong. But he would not bother anything, but he would eat their food, just enough of that meal. He wouldn't steal all their groceries. And he might take a shower. I bet you this man was looking for a job every day. But he kept on breaking in houses and stealing food until he was rearrested. This is what happens. When you don't give someone any opportunity to take care of themselves, to provide for their families, it's very unfair to them and to the community at large. Because what are you saying to this person? You're saying to them, we throw you away. We don't want you to be able to eat, feed yourself, take care of your family. We don't want you, period. Well, when you say that to a human being, that person has got to survive. So what you've done is you have placed the whole community at risk for your hard-heartedness. I say because of your hard-heartedness. Not everyone is a Christian like Jenny Strozier. Jenny Strozier takes his needs to God in prayer. And he knows that God not only hears prayers, but he answers them. And while we've been talking, I put up at my Facebook page and at my Google Plus page the information that our audience needs to pay into the Jenny Strozier Reentry Fund. This man worked behind bars. He wasn't sitting up like they have these false pictures of prisoners sitting up looking at color TV and going to a gym. This man was working, but he never earned a dime on his jobs behind bars. He didn't get unemployment. When he was released, he was suddenly unemployed. But released prisoners don't get unemployment benefits, and that's something that needs to change. But he has you and he has me. And what he's saying is that the Bible says you have not because you ask not and you ask amiss. He's asking us not for a handout, but for a hand up. We need to fill the gap that the government has left for our people who are re-entering society. Did you know that the President of the United States asked Congress last week for $3.7 billion, B, billion, for illegal aliens from Central America? Okay, $3.7 billion to give them food, clothing, housing, shelter, education, and health care. These are people who are mostly children entering the country illegally. Their parents send them here. First of all, is that something we want to encourage? The thing is, if we're not able to take care of our own, and Johnny Strozier is our own, he was born in this country. He worked in this country all of his life. Part of the time he was working behind bars. He's a good neighbor. He's ready to rejoin society and live a wholesome life. Should we give illegal aliens $3.7 billion and have no unemployment insurance set up for our re-entering prisoners who have worked their butts off behind bars? I tell you, I believe in helping neighbors, but I say to you that the Bible says that anyone at all who helps neighbors before they help their own and people in their own household is less than an infidel. So we need to concentrate on our people. And we can begin right here, right now, by having a program like the one you said the president is supporting for tax breaks for companies that hire ex-felons. We want to also do something more immediate than that. We need to send some money to Johnny Strozier's reentry fund. He has a $300 overrun of expenses this month that are not covered by his part-time job. He has a situation where he must have a cell phone so that the probation officer can call him. He has to have that. Some ex-felons have to wear an ankle bracelet. He traded his for a cell phone because they ordered it. But now he has to pay the cell phone bill. He has other expenses, naturally, just his rent and his food and his whatever it is that he needs, but he has probation fees to pay also. So now what I'm asking you to do is not only to pay into the Johnny Strozier reentry fund, but since Mr. Strozier has immediate financial needs, I ask you to send him a Western Union donation. Western Union right now is sending Western Union money for zero if you send it online. Now, I don't know how much you can send for zero, but it's probably as much as you would send, you know, to Mr. Strozier anyway. But I put the link down there, and I ask you to look at it. Now, when you contact Western Union, and you can just sit right there and just ring them up or just sit right there at your computer and connect with Western Union. Ask them to take $10 or $100, or some of you business people can afford to give Mr. Strozier $1,000 as a leg up on his new life, he and his lovely wife. Especially you people who've been earning prison profits, don't you have any conscience? Give Mr. Strozier a help. Give him a helping hand. Just send it to Western Union, and what I say is that you can do it online, you can do it on the phone with Western Union. Tell them that your donation is for Johnny Strozier, and you spell his name J-O-H-N-N-Y, S-T-R-O-Z-I-E-R. And you give his phone number, and that way Western Union will call him and let him know they have a donation for him. And his phone number is 678-516-4993. Again, Johnny Strozier's phone number is 678 516-4993. Western Union will use that phone number and his name, and they will accept his funds. And ask you to please tell Western Union to go ahead and request an ID, because you see a lot of people are hearing us say this, and so we want only Jenny Strozier in Georgia to pick up those funds in Georgia. And so ask Western Union to request an ID. And that's it. You can sit right there in front of your computer and send Jenny Strozier $10, $100, $1,000. Or you can go ahead and make a phone call to Western Union, and they will bill your debit card, your credit card. I think they even take, in some cases, they may take checks. You can check on that. But it's very easy for you to help Mr. Strozier get back to wholesome living. This man was incarcerated at age 10 years old. 10 years old, but because he was you see how intelligent he is, you see how active his mind is now in his mid-50s. When he was 10, he was a hell of a kid, and he figured out ways how to break out of the juvenile facility where he was held. And every time he broke out, they would add more time to his sentence. Until when he was 16, they transferred him at 16 years old to an adult prison in Georgia. And when Mr. Strozier got to the adult prison, all the inmates were mostly older than him. And one night, Mr. Strozier saw a horrible thing. He told us about it on one of his earlier shows, and I ask you to go to Human Rights Demand and listen to Mr. Strozier's earlier shows. He told us about the day he saw a prison guard kill an inmate. Well, he was only 16. That should have been something perhaps that he should have kept to himself. But he told the other inmates what he had seen. And do you know what they did to this young boy? They told him, well, now you've got to kill that guard. I know his heart dropped when they told him that. If you don't kill the guard, we're going to kill you. And they meant every word of it. So they gave Jenny Strozier a knife, and they insisted that he go and kill the guard who he had seen kill an inmate. Jenny Strozier, I asked him, I said, well, what did you do, Mr. Strozier? And he said, I tried my best to kill the guard. I tried my best to kill the guard. What I like about Jenny Strozier is he's not somebody who's trying to come to us and say, I'm innocent. I never did a thing wrong. He tells us that he was a child who was unruly. He went to juvenile. He kept getting his sentence lifted because he would not stay there. He tried to go home. In fact, he did break out and went home one time, or maybe more than one time. And so then when he got 16 and reached prison, the other inmates corrupted him further than he was, and they insisted that he kill a guard who he had seen kill an inmate. Jenny Strozier was put on death row for a little while that guard struggled for his life. But God blessed Jenny Strozier. That guard did not die, and so Jenny Strozier was not executed. That's when the warden told him not long after that he would be in jail the rest of his natural life. They lengthened his sentence and gave him 90 years, man, that. But Jenny Strozier went through a change in the 1980s. He was in solitary confinement, and a preacher, a prison, what do they call them, prison chaplain, came to visit with Jenny Strozier. And he told him, I know a man who can change you. Jenny Strozier, why don't you take it from here and let the people know how you got changed in prison? You take it from here.
Yes, ma'am. I remember the warden telling me, he said, Mr. Strozier, you will never get out of solitary confinement. you will die in him. If you don't die in him, if you don't get free and walk out of here a free man, you will die in this cell. But I became to be the prison worst nightmare when he told me that. You know, I would act out. I would fight the guard. I would do whatever I had to do. You know what I mean? They at one time, they put me on five-man escort. That mean that five armed guards had to escort me through the prison. Anytime I come out, go to shower, go to yard, they couldn't give me ice or hot water. Only that response team, the CERT, they used to call them CERT team, then SIT squad. But I remember this preacher coming in the cell block. And he came to my door, and he said, "Warden told me that you was the worst inmate in this prison." He said, "But I know a man that can change that." I said, "Man," I told him, I said, "Man, if you don't get out around my door," he was trying to tell me about Jesus. I said, "Man, I don't want to hear that, because I was too stuck into my own ways, and that's where the devil had me. Because I was doing the things of the devil. The devil, I was his right-hand man when I was in prison. But that night, while I was in that cell, the Holy Spirit really dealt with me in that cell. And I was dealing with some things that I couldn't answer. I was dealing with some things that I didn't know nothing about. So the next time that preacher came in there, I said, "Preacher, preacher, 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 come up here. I need to talk to you." So when he came in there, I said, "Man, I want to know, who is this Jesus you talking about? I want to know how I can accept this Jesus." And right then, me and him said the sinner's prayer. And when he said the sinner's prayer, something just moved over me like I have never moved over me in my life. But then, you know, I told him, I said, "You know, the warden told me that I'd never leave this cell block, that I'd die in this cell block." He said, "Have you prayed about that?" I said, "No, sir." He said, "Let's pray right now." So we started praying together. And about 15 minutes later, my name came across the intercom. And it said, "General Scrooge, pack up. You going to general population." And I was shocked. I couldn't believe that I was going to general population when the warden said I wasn't going. But some moved over the warden, and I was in general population. But then, you know, just being in general population don't change that. Because I started the church for 3 years on the back row, scared to death. The devil had me scared to death. I was bound in church on the back row. But a man came in there, and he said, "Do anybody in here want to give a testimony?" I fold my arm, because I definitely didn't want to get no testimony. But it had me folding my arm so tight, came loose, and my arm went up. And he said, "Young man, come on up." And as I was walking up through the church, I was saying to myself, "Man, what am I going to say to these inmates? What can I say? I don't know nothing about no what's going on, no testimony. I didn't know nothing about no testimony." But I got up there in front of the church, and the words just started coming out. That was back in 1985. The word just started coming out. I started giving that testimony. And the guys that were sitting in the church was telling me, "Man, I didn't know you went through that. I didn't know, out of all these years I know you, I didn't know you had went through that." You know what I'm saying? So right then, that's when God really started working on me. And he started working on me as I came with an idea about KCOP. KCOP stands for Keep Cheering Out of Prison. It's a ministry that I started while I was in prison. I didn't have to wait to start my ministry when I got out of prison. I started it while I was in prison. So when I got out, God already was moving on me to go to this church, that church, you know, but while being in there, seeing all the young men in prison that come in, you know, my heart went out to them. You know, I didn't want to see them go through what I went through. You know, I remember a lady coming to visit me while I was in prison. And she was telling me about the henna man. She said, I see a man in you that is dying to get out. And I want to know who that was, because I sure didn't see it. But I went back and I learned about the inner man. I learned who he is. I learned how to take the old man off and put the new man on. Because God did say that once you become a new creature in Christ, all the old things you did is the past. The past is the past. He throwed it in the forgetting sea of life. You know what I'm saying? So everything that I did in the past, God has forgiven me. All I ask is that society forgive me. If that society forgive me for the thing, the wrong things I did. Being at a young age, I didn't know no better. I didn't know what I was doing. But becoming a man, being in prison, coming from a child to a man, you learn a lot of things. You learn a lot of things. You learn what to do and what not to do. You learn that freedom is more important than being in prison. Being in prison is just like being in a cardboard box. Just get inside of it and let somebody tape it up. That's how prison is. You're in a box. You're in a hole. It's black dog. You can't see nobody. You can't talk to nobody. Don't nobody even know you're in now. You don't know when you're going to eat. You don't know when you're going to go to sleep because you already in the dog. So if you close your eyes, you're going to be in more dog. So, you know, you got people in prison been in there way longer than me. You got some been in there 50 years, 60 years. Some ain't going to never get out. They're going to die there. Some already done died in there. You know, but I was blessed to be one of the ones to come out. I was blessed to be one of the ones to come out to tell my story, to give my testimony, to let somebody know, yeah, I did the crime and I did the time. I ain't crying about it. I ain't mad about it. I ain't out there in society trying to get evil because I spent half my life in prison. I know that my life is going to be better. It's going to get better in time. You know, they said that you only get better. It's like wine. You only get better with time. You see what I'm saying? My life is just like wine. I only get better with time. As long as you keep the cap on it, I'm just going to get good and good and good. Ms. Mary?
Thank you, Mr. Strozier. I just congratulate you for keeping your positive outlook as you meet the challenges. You're meeting the challenges of a re-entering person. You are meeting these challenges. You got out there. Your wife said that you went door to door and applied for jobs. She said that you're a hard-working man, and that your heart's desire is to take care of your family. And that's like any man. And I'm asking right now, you know, I heard something you said. You said you asked God for forgiveness, and now you ask society to please forgive you. I ask for more than that. I ask for society to not only forgive you, but I ask for us to beg your pardon, because a little boy, 10 years old, to go to prison and stay until he's in his mid-50s, you know, this is not what you say, but this is what I say. Society should beg your pardon, because we need to start doing something more positive with our children than suspending them from school.
Yes.
We need to do something positive than to send them away behind bars. We need to have better programs, especially jobs programs for our young teenagers. We need to have mentoring programs for our young children who need a father image or who need strong mentoring. We need, instead of the principal reaching for the phone to call the police, he needs to be able to say to a young man or young woman, well, you know what? From what you just did, I think you need a mentor, and I'm going to call and have you one here in the morning, stop by here in the morning and meet her or meet him. We need alternatives to incarceration for little kids, 10 years old, even teenagers.
Yes.
And so I say to you that I beg your pardon, Mr. Strozier, because I didn't even know these things were happening. I didn't know that 2.3 million people were in prison. I was so shocked by it that one year, I think it was 2010, I went to the Auburn Street Festival downtown Atlanta. I had made flyers to pass out. I wanted people to know that there was slavery going on in Georgia and throughout the nation. I didn't think they knew it. I thought I had discovered something that nobody else knew, especially the way the cyber stalkers were attacking my computer. I thought, oh, other people don't know this. Let me go tell them. So I got out there and I went to that big crowd of people at the Auburn Street Festivals. And if you've never been, audience, you certainly need to come to Atlanta for the Auburn Street Festival. And I was just walking and handing out flyers. And people looked at the flyers and they said, oh, we know this. I said, you know that they're arresting people for money? And he said, oh, yeah. I said, you know that prison slavery is happening right now? He said, yes, I have a friend in prison. And I said, well, how did this happen? How is it that so many people I talked to today knew that this was happening and you're not doing anything about it? You're not saying anything about it. You're not marching. You're not singing. You're not protesting. Why is it that you've let slavery grow back up among us? Why have you done this with full knowledge that it's happening, you know? And so ever since I found out about it, I have been fighting against mass incarceration. I've been fighting against the war on drugs. I've been fighting against discrimination in the laws that make black people have 100-to-1 sentencing for cocaine. I've been fighting against the girlfriend law where they were throwing women in prison with no criminal charges, no crimes whatsoever, if they were whipped, if they had a spouse or a lover who was selling drugs. They throw the woman in jail for the same amount of time without proving any crime against her at all. That's criminal on the system's part.
Yes.
So I've been raising my voice against this all this time, and 99% of the people that I have met, because I deal with wrongful convictions and I deal with the mentally ill behind bars, 90% of the people who I've met have been people who say they're innocent. When I listened to you and you said, I did it, I was taken aback. I said, this is the first man I've ever met who acknowledged that he made a mistake, that he broke the law, that he did something wrong. And to tell you the truth, you got more reason to make excuses or to offer an explanation than some of the other people, because you went to prison at 10 years of age. That's not even the age of accountability. And now I say to you, ladies and gentlemen, in our audience, let's give this man the forgiveness that he asked for. And let's also beg his pardon for our apathy while he was in jail 46 years, 15 in solitary confinement. He was in solitary confinement in that prison torture so long that he tried to kill himself. He and a friend in solitary confinement decided to kill themselves together one day.
Yeah.
But Dennis Strozier jumped. He tied some around his neck, and when he jumped, whatever he had tied didn't hold him, and he lived, and the other man died. I'm about to cry now to think about the inhumanity that we heap on people because they made a mistake, because they sinned like we all have. And I ask you right now to welcome this brother back into society. And please, if you can't do it one right now, please go to the Jenny Strozier Reentry Fund or go to Western Union Online and drop this brother $10. You may not be have it all like that where you can send him $100 or $1,000, but just send him $10 and say, congratulations, brother, and welcome home. I'm going to turn it over to this caller now, 5153.
Hello?
Hello.
Yes, hello. Greetings and solidarity. My name is Lamar. I just called. I realized it was Friday, right after 6:30, and this is my first time calling in, and I'm new to this blog thing and all that. But long story short, I got radicalized while inside solitary confinement. I was a GBMI, guilty but mentally ill, sentenced prisoner, sentenced to 5 to 15 for aggravated assault and gun charges. You know what I'm saying? And while inside, I went through a whole lot of oppression, there was things I seen in there that I didn't even know, you know, went on, you know, and a lot of stuff that goes on that they don't show on MSNBC and Cops Raw and all that, you know, the stuff that, you know, the COs, the correctional officers, do that, you know, such as not feeding folks, this, that, and the third. I'm glad the brother, I hope the brother gets out, you know what I'm saying, 46 years inside of, systemic oppression can only really, in my opinion, lead to two things, suicide or a revolutionary, however somebody may interpret that. But somebody who's willing to revolt against a life that they no longer do not see conducive to their well-being. So, I'm involved with Black Autonomy Federation. I do conferences, and I'm also affiliated with IWW, IWOC, Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee. Prisoners can now join the IWW for free. So if you know any prisoners in strike mode, please alert them to the fact that prisoners can now join the Industrial Workers of the World Union for free. So in a nutshell, so to speak, that's, yeah. Hello?
Hello?
Oh, yeah. Oh, and
yes,
so,
yeah.
So, I'm sorry. Oh, okay. And, so right now I live on the south side of Chicago, Englewood, and, I was sleeping on the street, me and my compañera, so we turned the board up into a base area of resistance. We use it to conduct community meetings out of and to do workshops out of supporters such as South Chicago Anarchist Black Cross with Anthony Racin, Sister Jonana Irvin, and Brother Lorenzo Camboa Irvin down Memphis, and Brianna out Kansas City IWW. Have been resourceful in providing us with materials to help us with the liberation school. And this, for me, is my therapy. This is what I used to pace myself, 7.5 steps one way, 7.5 steps back, thinking about doing. And so I'm living my ideal existence, and I feel healthy doing it. I feel my most healthiest living free like this instead of having my hands tied behind my back when, you know, cuff behind my back when it comes to rent or anything like that because I can't afford it. In my neighborhood alone, there's 400 abandoned buildings. So we just took one of them and turned it into a base area of resistance. So, yeah, that's basically who's on the line right now is Sister Mary. Is Sister Mary Neal on the phone?
Yes, I'm on the phone, and I'm so glad you called in. Your name is
Brother Lamar,
you're affiliated with a great friend of justice, a great friend of mine, and that is Mr. Lorenzo Irving and his beautiful wife, Jonina Irving. They are, like you said, with the Black Autonomy Federation. They are correct. Working with Police Violence in Memphis, Tennessee. And Memphis, Tennessee is a town that I think is really improving for their advocacy, because I haven't heard of a police murder in Memphis in a few months. And so this was something that was happening pretty much monthly, because I know that there were 23 deaths by police between 2012 and 2013, 23 people. And I have not heard of a death by police in Memphis in a number of months. So I want to congratulate Lorenzo Irving and his lovely wife, Jonina Irving, for helping to improve the situation regarding police violence in Memphis, Tennessee. And
phenomenal.
Oh, absolutely. I want to thank you for coming on this Blog Talk Radio show. We're on usually 5 days a week, but this week we'll be on all 7 days. Tomorrow at 3 p.m., we have a mother who's coming on, and you please come too, Mr. Strozier. Please come, Mrs. Strozier. We have a mother who's coming on. Her name is Valerie. Her son was mentally ill. He was murdered in a Florida prison. They sprayed him in the face with pepper spray, and then when they sprayed him right in the face, his mucous membranes were swelling. He was trying to get the pepper spray out of his eyes, trying to snot it out of his nose and his mouth. And what happened is then they put that spit cap over him to keep him from being able to spit on the guards and snot on the guards, because he was trying to get it out of his eyes and mouth. He was handcuffed behind the back. When they put that cap over his head, they walked him down the hall to the restraint room, and they locked him up in a restraint chair. But they did not remove that spit cap. So what happened is he suffocated within 1 hour. He was only 19 years old, and her name is Valerie. Will be on here today, tomorrow at 3 o'clock to talk to us about the wrongful death of her son, Daniel. We know that everybody in prison has many challenges, but I think that the mentally ill are the most people. They are the most challenged, all the prisoners, and they are oftentimes brutalized by other prisoners as well as the guards, and sometimes they are killed. So we want you to stand with Sister Valerie tomorrow at 3 p.m. Please spread the word, brother, and I'll let you continue, Mr. Strozier.
I want to say that, like Sister Valerie, I believe my wife was telling me maybe it might have been a week ago that the police had sprayed and killed another young man here in the state of Georgia. Baby, can you tell Ms. Mary about that situation?
Yes, I hadn't heard too much about it lately, but they were arresting him. It had been a domestic violence allegation, and they chased him, and he said that he couldn't breathe, and they handcuffed him, and they tased him 3 times, and he died. 20-year-old young man. So they're still doing things like that. My stepbrother died in a chair, in a restraint chair. He had a seizure, and they were trying to get help for him. They thought he was going through alcohol withdrawal, although the family tried to tell him he had a seizure and he needed medication, and he died. So they're still doing things like this.
May I add something? This is Lamar. I just wanted to add that, and has anybody on the phone been on the inside in the penitentiary?
My husband.
Yeah.
Okay. How you doing, bro? Are you familiar with the OBS units, the observation units?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now
I was
in the observation unit. Now, in the observation unit, now there's different forms of torture and forms of genocide and mental side is one of them. You know what I'm saying? It's inside of there, and the one I was in, All there is in the cell is a camera in the corner, a slab of concrete, and a toilet with the seat sealed and padlock closed. So and you have a plexiglass door or cell bars that you're being watched through at all times. So not only that, I was in a cell with the lights blinking on and off perpetually, like nonstop, for 6 months. Now, as my diagnosis was paranoid schizophrenia, PTSD, and depression. Now, you know what I'm saying, there was times where the lights used to flash, and I'd see, you know what I'm saying, when I'd see the incident that triggered, you know, symptoms, you know, stemming from my so-called illness. You know what I'm saying? So, and there's a whole lot of other things that go on too. That you know, in the OBS unit, you can't write, you don't get mail, you can't use a phone. You're totally blocked off. If you want to contact a lawyer or anyone, you're totally blocked off. If anyone wants to contact you, they're totally blocked off. No one knows what goes on in the OBS units except the people there. You know what I'm saying? And you know, and you. I mean, so
I was in one, you know, was when they put me in a cell, you know, and they turned the radio on, but they put it on country music, and they turned it up loud, and they turned it up real loud. See what I'm saying? So you know, by me being a black man, I sure didn't want to hear no country music. If you had to put it on for soul or something, okay.
Yeah.
Some country music, Merle Haggard. You know, you listen to country music all day long, loud, it'll drive you mentally insane.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But then, after I raised, beat on the door, and cussed the police out, they brought me lunch. You know, they brought me one green bean, a half a piece of bread, and some flour.
Yeah. Yeah, it's serious. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sometimes, what kind of people are they? And let me tell you what I say to them. One of these days, that may be your son or your daughter or your granddaughter, your great-granddaughter. Because you have to sometimes realize you're going to see again how you have mistreated people. And these people, male and female, are guards. Because when I went to see my husband, there was one prison, I won't call the name, I hated it. It was the closest prison my husband ever was to me, but it took me the longest to get there because I'm going to tell people to, they intimidate us as visitors because they hate the fact that you're getting a visitation, and they do everything they can to make you not want to come back. I have been in places where they turn the heat up. I've been in places where they turn the air up. I have, last time I went before my husband was released, they almost did a strip search on me because I had on a dress that had a buckle that had a little metal in it. And they took me back, and I said, God, this is it. I cannot go through this. I know people slip stuff in, and I know all of us have to reap the consequences of what people do. But I'm telling you that a lot of times those of us who come to visitation are taken through these little games. You know, this prison say you can wear this. This one say you can wear that. You don't know until you get there. I've seen people turned around, and then when you question them, my problem was I always had a question, and they didn't like to be questioned. I always wanted to get an answer. And the Department of Correction tell you, we don't have to tell you anything. The Department of Parole tell you, we don't have to tell you why we made that decision. A lot of times, you don't know what to do, and some people were frightened by the fact that you had to stand in this line and go through just to get in. But the point was, don't stop coming, because now you get a chance to see some stuff that nobody has seen or nobody wants you to see. But it's all kind of ways of mind control that they do, even coming to visitation and being turned around, not knowing and saying the inmate didn't give it to the counselor, well, the counselor didn't ask the inmate. So all these things are mind games played on people who come to visit as well to make you so upset you say something, you could get kicked out. Or you wear something that you don't know you shouldn't wear. You might see another person get by wearing something they told you not to wear. And from prison to prison, it's different because the warden makes the decisions on some of the things So it's no consistency, but you're expecting these men and these women to follow rules and regulations that you change every 5 minutes. And some people are afraid to go in there. I'm not afraid to go in here clinging door because, thank God, I knew I was coming out. But what about these men and women, like you're saying, Brother Mark, who have to go through more than what you went through with before you came in there? Instead of treating you, you're adding more to the plate. And then you get out here. Health care, my husband can't get health care. It's too high. They know he does not work, but he can't get health care. There's a Grady hospital who has a social hospital and a trauma hospital, but he can't get health care. So, it's, you know, and I heard Sister Mary say food stamps. If you had a drug charge, how are you going to eat? What are you supposed to do? If you can't get mental care, you can't get the essentials of life that has been taken away from you, and you're trying to start over. I have a problem with that.
Yeah, and Maslow's hierarchy of needs, you know what I'm saying? And I'm no behaviorist, you know what I'm saying? You know, even he, you know what I'm saying, that the fundamental needs was necessary to reach a level of self-actualization. So how are people going to reach a level of self-actualization if we don't have the fundamental needs of survival?
And, you know, we try to contact some of the politicians, and some of them want to, some anti. But let me tell you, recently in Georgia, we had an election, and there was a senator that wanted them to kind of go a little lighter on some of the sex offenders and the rules. You know he was, he finished out his term, but you know he was not reelected this term, don't you? Because some of that is unfair. I found out that sexually molested a child.
Hey, I'm terribly sorry. I'm in like the middle of traffic right now, and on my bike and shit. So, but I wanted to call, you know what I'm saying? But please let all those who, you know what I'm saying, who's locked up know that, you know what I'm saying, I send my solidarity, and you know what I'm saying, I'm working, you know, there's folks out here working to, you know, on prison abolition on a serious level, you know what I'm saying.
Well, thank you for calling, brother, and we hope you call back next Friday. Next Friday, we're on the air from 6:30 p.m. until 8:30 p.m. That's 2 hours, and we hope you will call every Friday. We also have other programs on Human Rights Demand. This program is named that because Frederick Douglass, an abolitionist of the 1800s, said that power concedes nothing without a demand. It never has, and it never will. We believe that here at Human Rights Demand, and we make a demand for human rights for everyone, even prisoners, even the mentally ill, even our Native Americans, especially our African Americans, everyone. We believe that everyone should be treated with their basic human rights respected, whether or not they're behind bars. And the importance of the Jenny Strozier Keeping It Real show is so that you will have an opportunity to interact with a man who went to prison at age 10 and stayed until his mid-50s and yet emerged a human being. He emerged a very gentle and a very determined man, determined to make his own way in life, determined to live a wholesome life. And we're asking for you and you and you to please help. We're not asking for a handout. We're asking for a hand up. And again, I say to you that my name is Mary Neal, N-E-A-L. And you will find on my Google Plus wall and also on my Facebook wall information as to how you can dial in or use your computer to go to Western Union and send Mr. Strozier an immediate offering, an immediate love offering, a welcome home offering, because he is $300 behind in his bills for this month. He works every day. He goes to work early and works as long as needed, but he only works part-time. That's all he could find right now. He does extra work by cutting yards. But this man needs a helping hand right now. And I ask all of my friends who talk about mass incarceration and we complain about it and we advocate for prisoners, I want you to do a bit more than talk and write posts. I want you to please, when you get your paycheck, when you get your disability or Social Security income, when you go to the bank again, pull out a few dollars, just put with other people's few dollars so that we can help Jenny Strozier to have a successful reentry. I'm asking us to do more than just talk about mass incarceration. Let us help someone who is reentering from the jail system. And I want to say that I wrote down my ideas, 10 ideas that would help reentry. And we have a few moments, so I'll just go over them real quickly, and then we'll get back to Mr. Strozier. My 10 suggestions are, number one, over half of America's inmates are mentally ill people who should have been treated in their communities or hospitalized and never imprisoned in the first place. Upon prison release, all inmates who were treated for mental health illness when they were released from prison, they should be put in AOT programs that provide subsistence assistance, food and housing, and mandate continuous psychiatric treatment, such as Laura's Law and Kendra's Law, K-E-N-D-R-A, apostrophe S, Law. Please look those up. Number two, all correctional facilities should focus on rehabilitation services, including skills training and opportunities to achieve high school diplomas and college degrees. Correctional facilities should be given incentives according to the number of inmates who become certified in a skill or are awarded diplomas and degrees. If you fix it so that the prisons, the wardens and the staff will get incentives for every inmate who completes his degree or completes his high school education, then they won't be resentful of the time this inmate has to spend in the library. They won't be making it tough for people to finish. And so that's why I say give the institutions that do have high school graduates and college graduates incentive awards. Number three, the Bureau of Prisons should make every attempt to keep prisoners in the area where they lived before incarceration, because studies indicate that released prisoners have a higher rate of success if they maintain close ties with their family and friends while incarcerated. Moving prisoners out of state should be avoided as it prevents visits. I know some people in the federal system who had a relative arrested in South Dakota, and the next thing they knew, their relative was incarcerated in Florida. And these are poor people. How can they travel from South Dakota to Florida to visit their relative? So please keep people as much as possible in the same local area where they will get visits from their friends and relatives, because those people have a higher success rate once they get out. Number four, companies and government entities that use prison labor should be mandated to hire a percentage of the released prisoners who work for them behind bars. Why would you rather hire someone completely inexperienced when you've got before you men and women who've already worked for your companies for years behind bars? Hire your employees. Hire your former prison employees. And then we have number five, released prisoners who worked. Your released prisoners' workers should qualify for unemployment benefits. They should be able to get out of prison and go down to the unemployment office and say, I worked for 5 years for Boeing Airlines. I worked for 6 years for the federal government making military uniforms. I worked for 10 years for Starbucks Coffee making those cups. And Starbucks Coffee and the USA and Boeing Airlines and all these other companies, Microsoft and all these other companies that do, they should have to pay unemployment to those released workers. And so then I say, number six, psychological therapy should be offered to all released prisoners to help them recover from PTSD. Dr. Williams, that's a psychologist we've had here on Human Rights Demand, he says that basically all prisoners are suffering from post-traumatic stress syndrome at some level. You've seen people get killed. You've seen people commit suicide. You've seen people be brutalized. You've been through some of those experiences yourself, solitary confinement. I think that everyone who's released from prison should qualify for free psychological assessments and help. And then number seven, job applications should not ask about people's criminal backgrounds. The job, that's called ban the box, and we should insist that that box be banned. Why are you asking about that? Sometimes the only difference between a person who's been to prison and a person who hasn't is that the person who hasn't is slicker than the one who went. Sometimes you are not hiring a criminal by having that on the job applications. You can get into that if you want to during the interview when the person is there to explain, but give the person a chance. Let them have an interview. So number eight, criminal background information should be expunged except for repeat sex offenders and violent criminals. Now, somebody murdered somebody, maybe that should still be up there. I don't know. But generally speaking, I think that criminal background information should be expunged. And number nine, voting rights should be fully restored. These people have served their time. Make them voters, and that also reduces recidivism. And number 10, ex-offenders should qualify for all entitlement programs and college assistance at the same rate as anyone else within their financial status. They should not be relegated to a permanent underclass. So, Mr. Strozier, you only have 1 minute. I want to give it to you so you can say goodnight and your wife can say goodnight. We so much appreciate you.
Good
yes,
night.
I'm gonna turn it over to my wife because she's a minister and Lord, and let her close it out or whatever she needs to close it out with. Okay.
I just want to thank you all for inviting me, even my husband. I appreciate the opportunity. I look forward to continue listening and to more opportunities to share information as we find it out. Again, I say thank you. God bless.
And I want to say this to the audience that I want everyone to just keep on, keep your head up. If you got somebody in prison, always love them because you got to love them first. Don't give up no matter what they're going through. Always stand by. Stay strong in the Lord because God is the answer and the key to everything. I just want to thank y'all for having me on this show, Miss Mary. I sincerely appreciate it. Thank you so very much for letting me tell my story the way it should have been told because I've been wanting to do this for a long, long time. But no one never did it.
Okay. Praise God. Thank you, audience, for joining us.